supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. We're talking about natural disasters today and the impact it has on everyone's lives who's involved. You know, we've been watching a lot of footage over the weeks about what's happening in Haiti, but we want to know more about the internal world of not just the people who have been victimized by the disaster over there, but, you know, first responders and families here who are watching helplessly and can't do anything about it. So to deal with all these issues, we're joined here in the studio by Dr. Stephen Berkowitz. He's a child and adolescent psychiatrist here at the University of Pennsylvania who specializes in trauma. He was formerly deputy director of the National Center of Children Exposed to Violence at Yale. We're also joined on the welcome, Stephen.
Thank you.
We're also joined on the telephone by Siddharth Shah. He's a physician who specializes in preventative medicine. He's also the founder of Greenleaf Integrated Strategies, which works with first responders who are sent in to work with disaster and trauma. They train people who work with the overseas disaster. Siddharth, welcome to the show.
Thank you for doing the show, Dan.
And later on, we're going to hear from Gerda Nicholas, who's a psychology professor at the University of Miami. She also specializes in trauma, and she is Haitian and has family in Haiti. But first, we're going to talk with our own WHYY reporter, Susan Phillips. Susan recently returned from reporting on the earthquake in Haiti. Susan, thanks for joining us.
No problem.
So, when we chatted a minute ago, you said you've been back a week, and you were there a week, but that seems like a month ago that you were there.
Well, it seemed like a month that I was there, and it seemed like the week or so, or a little over a week that I've been back is like a day, you know, sort of a flash in the pan compared to the week I was there.
So I want to obviously talk about that week. What made you decide to go to Haiti?
Well, you know, it's funny. I remember hearing the first reports Tuesday evening right as I was leaving work, and it was sort of in the background on CNN. And then the next morning, I woke up to NPR reports of the massive devastation of the earthquake. And then that day, you know, I started reporting the local angle by talking to Haitians living in the Delaware Valley, and they were all, as you can imagine, very worried about their families who they hadn't heard about, and a lot of them were raising money or making plans to go down there or sending aid down to Haiti. And my first thought was I'd love to go down with them and continue covering the local angle of the story through their eyes.
That was a reporter's mind, yes?
Yes.
Gave you some incentive.
Yeah.
Was there any emotion that drove you down there when you saw the devastation? Was there?
Of course. I mean, reporters are humans too. So, yeah, I mean, I was feeling horrible for the people I was talking to here who were just, you know, often in tears wondering what was happening with their family members. But for me, professionally, I thought also that this is a good story, and this is a story that, you know, needs to be told.
Had you ever been in a disaster before?
No.
What did you anticipate?
Well, by the time I got down there, there were enough reports that I knew there were a lot of people homeless, there were a lot of people injured. So I expected to see that. The group I went down with, I ended up going down with, went in through the Dominican Republic, and they ended up staying, for the most part, in the Dominican Republic on a border town. So I did a lot of stories from there. And then I did go into Haiti for a couple days, one day in Port-au-Prince. And, you know, everything sort of, when I went into Port-au-Prince, it looked just like it looked on CNN. It was absolute devastation. And I guess what surprised me was the number of people walking around. There just seemed to be so many people walking around through rubble. And
what was the impact on you? What was it like for you?
I think that when I first got there, when we first got to Himani, which where the doctors I was with from Cooper University Hospital were working in a couple hospitals in Himani on the border town, and it was just overwhelming. The one hospital there were people in the hallways, and the doctors there were overwhelmed. The doctors from Cooper were trying to figure out, how do we fit in here? And, you know, you heard a lot of screams and a lot of people in pain, and you saw people who had just had limbs amputated. You know, I saw bloody footprints on the floor of the hospital. I could smell rotting flesh. I could see open wounds. And I think at first that was very disturbing, as you can imagine. But after a while, you know, I just got used to it. You know, after the second or third day, these screams, you know, I was still impacted by it, but not as much, you know.
Do you still hear them?
No, I don't hear any screams. I still think about some of the people there. You know, there in one case, there was a woman. I was in the public hospital, and there was a woman lying on the floor in a hallway, sort of off to the side, and she had really, you know, bad wounds on her feet, and she was screaming because they were trying to clean the wound, which was infected, really badly infected. And she was screaming in Creole, but I could tell she was screaming for her mother. And she looked at me, and she was just, like, reaching her arms out to me. So I sort of had to put my equipment down, you know, and, like, hold her, because I just felt, you know, I know a lot of people debate this issue as to where does the journalist stop being the journalist and help out in this kind of situation. And in that kind of situation, I just felt that was my role, was not to be a journalist, but to actually hold her hand. Because she didn't know whether she was going to get her foot chopped off or not.
You said that was her role, and it also sounds like there was something deep inside of you that pulled you there also.
Well, yeah. I mean, I can't imagine being alone like that on a hallway, and I would want my mother, you know? I mean, she was a grown woman, but I could still, you know, hear her, like, calling out for God, for her mother, like, asking why. So if I were in that situation, I would want whoever was standing there to help me out, too.
What was it like for you, holding her?
Well, I was just trying to, like, calm her down as much as possible. So I just, you know, I was trying to, like, distract her from what the doctors were doing and give her just, like, a hand to clench. And it was really, really hot, too. So I was sort of taking my hat. I took my hat off and was fanning her and trying to just, and she seemed to calm down. I mean, it seemed to work in some way. What it was like for me, I don't know. I mean, can you ask a more specific question?
I don't think so.
I mean, it just was something I felt somebody else needed me, and I just...
Did you, in a way, feel closer to her?
Oh, yeah. I mean, even though we didn't speak the same language, it's almost like I could... I knew exactly what she was saying, and I knew exactly what she needed at that moment in time.
Yeah, that's terribly powerful. We want to hear from you if you've been exposed to a natural disaster or if a loved one has. Our number is 888-477-9499. We'd love to hear your story. 888-477-9499. Susan, you referred to a little girl who had an amputation. I want to listen to a cut that you recorded. It's a nurse who was dealing with that little girl, and she was explaining what was happening, and why this girl was screaming, apparently hysterically, almost out of control. Let's listen.
It's a very traumatic experience for her. So she's also experiencing post-traumatic stress. So anytime someone touches her, think, she's lost her leg. She's a little girl. So anytime anyone in the medical field comes close to her, she thinks she's going to lose another part of her body. She thinks we're going to just inflict a lot of pain. So we leave her till last so we can take a lot of time with her. And usually takes a lot more personnel with her, too. Because little as she is, she's very strong.
Stephen, I want to follow up this clip with you, because there's a cultural context here. You know, and somehow this nurse knew what it meant and what to do. Is it a cultural context, or is it a human context, much like Susan just said? You know, it's just a very human reaction.
I think in both cases we're seeing what is really human, which is about being connected, and that how much we heal and overcome when there's attachment and connectedness and support between people. So I think recognizing this nurse, who's obviously skilled, what was going on for this little girl, as did Susan with the woman in the hallway, is what makes us resilient and able to survive the worst possible things that we can imagine. I mean, I can't imagine what's going on in Haiti right now, but somehow people are resilient because of the connections and support they feel with one another.
Siddharth, you want to weigh in on that, Siddharth Shah?
Well, I think quite rightly that there's a kind of a human intuition that plays into all of this. I think oftentimes there's difficulties when people try to generalize an approach that may or may not fit with a cultural context. It's probably not useful to superimpose our response to 9/11 to the response in Haiti. There's going to be so many other specific needs that need to be dealt with, and we need to listen to the people on the ground in Haiti to figure out those responses.
To get our guidance from them. Susan, I want to turn back to you. What was the doctor's reaction that you saw?
Specifically to this little girl?
In general.
Well, I think they were all at different points in their lives. Some of them were very young, you know, residents, but they were all sort of used to working in emergency rooms, working in trauma centers.
Coming from Cooper Hospital, they know trauma.
They know trauma, of course. And I think the thing that I heard over and over again was, well, the intensity of the trauma, the intensity of the needs of the patients they had never seen before. Now, Nancy Cadet, who was the nurse, you know, the clip that you played, she had seen a lot before. She had been, you know, an Army nurse, and she had been in these situations. So she, you know, she was really good with this little girl. And when the doctors did stop to clean her wound, this little girl was screaming before the doctors even got to her. She just was terrified of them. Like, they didn't have to touch her before she started to scream. And what I found was that they were really, really good with her. Really good. And Nancy spoke Creole, so she could speak to her in Creole. And they, you know, they did their best.
Did any of the doctors look like they were shocky? And a little bit of shock? Kind of numb to their emotions?
I didn't see that they were numb to their emotions. I saw that, you know, there are times where they have to set them aside to just take care of somebody and not worry, you know. I think they did the best they could with the limited amount of anesthesia they had. You know, there was a lot of situations where they couldn't give them a lot of anesthesia. And, I mean, there was one... But the doctors were incredibly passionate about their patients. And, you know, in one case, there was a burn victim. And I ran into a couple doctors right after they had treated this man who had been sitting outside a hospital for a week in Port-au-Prince with 40% of his body burned with second and third degree burns. I don't know how he was still alive. But by the time he made it to the Dominican Republic, to this border town, he also sat outside the hospital for 2 days because there weren't any doctors there who knew what to do. So once the Cooper team got there, there was a trauma surgeon who knew what to do. And so a team of them worked on this man. And when they ran into me right after that operation, the first thing they said to me was, you know, Susan, can you help us try to get this man to the United States to a burn unit or he's going to die? You know, they were very, you know, concerned about what would happen in the post-operative care, and they got very attached to their patients.
Were you able to get him here? Were you able to help?
Personally, I wasn't, but I did hear later from one of the doctors that I think he was flown to the U.S. comfort ship, but I don't know how he is.
Tell me about people before we take our break. Tell me about people over there you connected with, learned from, think about today.
You know, I guess there's the mother, certainly that woman in the hallway I think about, but I also think about the mother of that little girl. I guess the one thing about that little girl is I kind of felt connected to her because I felt like that would have been my reaction if I were her age. I would have been terrified because just from my own personal experiences with doctors, you know, as a child, I would have been just as terrified as her and would have been screaming before the doctors even touched me. But the mother sort of stays with me too because she had to walk out of the room. She was in so much anguish. I mean, she felt a lot of guilt. And she just couldn't, at a certain point, she just couldn't take the pain that her daughter was in, and she had to walk out, and she was just kind of weeping outside of the room when that was going on. So she sort of sticks with me too. But I did hear from the doctors and nurses that little girl's doing a lot better because they put her in a unit with a lot of other kids who are also amputees. And once they did that, she started talking and sort of, you know, started to get a lot better psychologically.
Last question before our break. I know it's early to ask this question after just a week. Do you think this experience is going to have an impact on your life in the long run?
I think so. I don't think an experience like that can't have some kind of impact. You know, there's the professional impact, purely the professional impact in that, you know, now I know a lot more about what to do in a situation like that or covering a natural disaster. Just little things I know better. But in terms of how it impacts me emotionally, I mean, it's not as if I hadn't seen people suffered before. It's not as if, you know, I'd seen people shot. I'd seen, you know, a lot of suffering before that. But the intensity of the suffering is something that the amount of people at one time who were suffering is not anything I'd ever seen before. But at the same time, the amount of people who really wanted to help and just dropped everything to help and did whatever they could was, you know, really inspiring as well.
Susan, I want to thank you for the work you've done with this. Of course, all the work you do here. I want to thank you for joining us. And I also want to tell our audience that Susan put together an amazing body of work with audio clips and photographs and stories, and you can find them all on our website, hyy.org/voices. It'll be a wonderful and powerful experience for you. So thank you again, Susan.
Sure.
I really appreciate
it. My pleasure.
We'll be back after a short break. We are talking about natural disaster, the psychological impact of natural disaster. When we come back, we'll talk more with Steve Berkowitz, who's here in the studio, child and adolescent psychiatrist at the University of Pennsylvania. He contributed to the Psychological First Aid Manual used by the Substance Abuse Mental Health Administration, which was employed after Hurricane Katrina. I'm also joined by Siddharth Shah. He's a physician, specializes in preventative medicine, and he's the founder of Greenleaf Integrated Strategies. They train first responders to go in all over the world. And we'd like to hear from you if you've got experience, personal experience, with natural disasters yourself or a family member. Our number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Cancer prevention is a vital part of Fox Chase's mission. By providing cancer screening and conducting research on cancer prevention, Fox Chase is well positioned to deliver targeted, team-based cancer care. This comprehensive approach includes risk assessment, colonoscopy, a breast imaging center of excellence, evaluating Barrett's esophagus, and DEXA scan testing for bone loss. Fox Chase, perfecting the science of compassionate cancer care.
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. It's easy and inexpensive for almost anyone to be a journalist these days, but how trustworthy is all the news and commentary you encounter? WHYY still practices journalism the old-fashioned way. We check the facts and make sure the stories you hear are fair, balanced, and trustworthy. We need your financial support to keep WHYY on the radio. Please call 1-888-345-9499 or give online at whyy.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We are talking about the emotional impact of natural disasters, not just on the people who experience them, but their loved ones who were at a distance, first responders. My guests are Siddhar Shah. He's a physician, and he is the founder of Greenleaf Integrated Strategies, the train workers who go into disaster and traumatic situations. They work with first responders. I'm joined here in the studio by Dr. Steve Berkowitz. He's a child and adolescent psychiatrist at Penn. He was deputy director of the National Center of Children Exposed to Violence at Yale. So I want to understand this business of trauma and how we understand it. And I'll turn to you, Steve. You know, we look at an earthquake or a tsunami, and we call that traumatic. But trauma is not so much about what happens, is it?
No, that's very much true, Dan. It really is the experience, the subjective experience of the individual who has that event occur. And all of us react and experience these things differently. Some may be traumatized by them. Some may not. Most of us have a period of feeling some disease or discomfort. We may be jittery or have bad night sleeping, but we don't go on over a long term period of time to really feel impaired by our experience.
Well, okay, so events are not traumas, but some events are more traumatic than others, like an event that gets repeated over and over. But I wonder, you know, you take a one-time event, and we know they are less traumatic than sustained events. You take a one-time event, but you look at Katrina and Haiti, and, you know, on a meteorologic level, it's a one-time event, but it's sustained suffering. Is that likely to be more traumatic?
Absolutely. I think one of the things that distinguishes disasters and events of terrorism from individual traumas that may be experienced in day-to-day life or, you know, a shooting or something like that, is that the infrastructure is destroyed and the stress continues over the long term. And trauma is a process that occurs because those small things over time or large things over time may exacerbate the initial experience and the initial level express to the point where that event was traumatizing.
Siddharth, you were in Pakistan after the earthquake and in India after the tsunami. Tell us what people experienced in the immediate aftermath and then weeks later.
Well, you know, here on the Atlantic seaboard, we've had the snow in Washington, D.C. in particular. We've been hit here. And people sort of know what it's like to be, that there's an ongoing stressor around. Now, multiply that tenfold, a hundredfold for people who were affected by an earthquake or the tsunami, where, as Stephen said, the infrastructure is not working. So the very institutions, the very roads, the schools, the getting in touch with people through communications, all of those things are not reliable anymore. And there is this sense of uncertainty that also compounds the sense of insecurity that the original earthquake or tsunami has caused. So this, you compound it and you compound it, and it causes quite a bit of, it's like a stalling effect in the brain, where the brain doesn't know exactly what to do to be safe, to be secure.
When you say a stalling effect, are you, you're not talking about shock?
Well, shock certainly occurs in the immediate aftermath, but then that you can have a kind of a longer period of time where a person doesn't know what action he or she should take in order to safeguard themselves or to move on. And there's so many uncertainties and question marks. I personally have never been in a setting where a disaster has occurred in real time for me. So I honestly can't imagine what it would be like for that to occur to me and then to just not know what to do next.
Well, I think all of us have had that experience in moments. You know, like something terrible happens and all of us have said, oh my God, what am I going to do now? But we usually have an answer in a matter of seconds. You know, we have an idea of what we're going to do now. But what you're describing is that, oh my God, what are we going to do now? That gets sustained over days and weeks.
Precisely. And then also your social network is in the same boat that you are. I mean, everybody is wondering what to do sometimes. There may be one person in a group that has a better idea, more concrete idea, and oftentimes that person can become the ad hoc leader because people in times of uncertainty need some kind of leadership, some kind of concrete action in order to rebuild their life. Unfortunately, in a circumstance like Haiti, that kind of leadership maybe it doesn't come when just because people want it. It happens in very non-uniform situations, so it's a kind of a hit and miss type of thing, and well, that's part of tragedy.
I want to turn to you, Stephen, about this social context in which these things happen. So, what's the impact of a community experiencing a disaster together versus somebody getting hit by lightning or a car accident or, you know, where it is a person or a family?
I think one, what Siddharth mentioned was how it's just compounded. And I think that's a very important point, that that when a community is struck, and particularly when the infrastructure, means of supporting oneself, so on and so forth, are destroyed, it gets compounded and built on. Now, with that said, communities can come together with support from leadership and external authority in ways that can be really promote recovery and healing. So that's the role of spirituality, of community resources, of that social connectedness. So it's devastated community. On the other hand, communities that can be supported and brought together can really thrive and grow effectively after these experiences.
Hmm. I want to follow up talking about communities. We know there was a disaster in Connecticut just yesterday. Gas power plant
That was being built exploded while they were working on it. Yes,
and 5 people were killed. I don't know how many were injured. But apparently this is felt like an earthquake that could be felt around the state from what I read. So what do you think the impact would have on the larger community in Connecticut, if any?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think there will be one of the things that occurs often, as you know, is in order to deal with feeling overwhelmed and helpless by events that sometimes we have no control over, we look for responsibility. We look for blame. We look to whose fault is this? And that helps us feel that at least we had control of our situation. And that can have long-term effects on communities when they're looking for blame and uncovering whether or not it's actually factual and appropriate.
Like what kind of effect? You said long-term
effect. Well, by causing some dissolution of relationships in looking for the blame. We're a society that always wants to find whose fault it is.
Well, and even blaming ourselves. I'm thinking of Susan Phillips describing the mother, you know, who felt guilty over what happened to her daughter, even though she had no control over it.
And that is a very, very common experience that people have. They blame themselves. They blame their or parents blame themselves. Usually in an effort, it's a sort of strange paradox, but usually in an effort to feel some control. You blame yourself, which is better than feeling that you're absolutely helpless, which when I felt that way, it's one of the worst imaginable feelings to have.
Yeah, it's not pleasurable. Siddharth, who is more likely to develop PTSD, and what are some of the protective factors?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. I think one thing that I'd like to convey to your listeners is that PTSD has been publicized a lot, and I think rightly, because it was a formerly unknown phenomenon, but it's also not the only condition that we want to look out for a traumatizing situation. So traumatizing situations can cause a whole host of issues from substance abuse, poor medical health, and yeah, you heard me correctly, poor medical health after a psychological insult is also possible, and there are a lot of good physiologic reasons for that. Work and relationship disturbances occur. Family conflict can increase. So who's
at more risk?
Well, certainly vulnerable populations. Studies have shown vulnerable populations such as women and caregivers, children, people who are closer to the actual event. So certainly geographic distance can cause it. But then actually after we found after September 11th, people watching television and watching television footage and not being able to disengage from that television footage, even if they weren't there during the occurrence, they're not anywhere close to New York City, they can be exposed to the trauma because, as Stephen said, it's the response to the event, not the event itself, which is the source of trauma.
I wonder if there are community differences. For example, I read a study that showed 25% of people in Florida who experienced Hurricane Andrew had PTSD, and after the tsunami, it was estimated that 10% had PTSD. Stephen, do you want to weigh in on that?
Yes, I think that those are really important issues, and I want to add a little bit to who's at risk, because I think there's a wonderful meta-analysis that was done by a woman named Fran Norris of all the disaster research in mental health. And the thing that holds up time and time again, both for individuals and for countries, is that resources, poverty, is the worst predictor of outcome. And I think that's really notable, and we've experienced that certainly with Haiti being one of the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, and in the Gulf states, in Louisiana and New Orleans, certainly, where poverty played a major role in the long-term outcomes for many people.
I wonder, though, looking at Haiti, and when we come back from our break, we're going to be talking with psychologist Gerda Nicholas, who is Haitian, working in University of Miami. So, you know, the question I have, and I will pose to her, is Haiti has been devastated with war, with hunger, with weather, with poverty. And in a way, I wonder if that makes them at more risk, if it makes them more resilient, or both. You know, I guess we will allow her to answer it. Before we go to the break, tell me about kids. In general, of course, kids cope with disaster differently than adults. Do they tend to be more resilient?
I think it varies. I think the risk factors for resilience are the same. But I think that one of the things that kids have on their side is that as they're maturing, they're always integrating new experiences, and they're more effective at it than us older folks. And so with the right support, I think Susan mentioned, once this little girl who had her leg amputated was in a group of other kids like her, and they were doing kid things. She seemed to come out of her show. I think that kind of support, that kind of opportunity is something that we see in kids often that is different than adults who are looking at the long-term stresses, and kids are more able to integrate and live in the moment.
So what do parents need to know to care for kids who have been exposed to trauma?
A couple things. One, that they need to be available and supportive and watching out for signs of difficulty, but also to let their kids be kids. Sometimes we see parents who are really surprised that their kids seem to be flourishing or doing okay, playing, and the parents don't understand that. And I've seen parents actually interfere, thinking that it was an inappropriate thing for a child to do, when in fact it's their way of coping and managing and processing the events that they've experienced.
Of course, too many of us shrinks would call that denial, too, if somebody's having fun after trauma.
Denial's a fine thing if it works.
Yeah, you're not kidding. Let's go to a break. When we come back, we're going to continue talking with Stephen Berkowitz, child and adolescent psychiatrist at Penn who specializes in trauma. We'll also speak with Siddharth Shah, who founded Greenleaf Integrated Strategies, which trains first responders to go into disaster areas all over the world. And we'll also be speaking with Gerda Nicholas, a psychology professor at University of Miami, who specializes in trauma, and she has family in Haiti. Well, we'll be back in just 60 seconds. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Widener University supports WHYY. Widener's MBA program is designed to deliver the practical theory and professional training required to lead in the global business arena. Details at widener.edu.
I'm Marty Moskowain. At WHYY, we value our editorial independence, and we believe you do too. A rigorous editorial process ensures that the stories you hear are fair, balanced, and accurately reported. That might seem old-fashioned, but it's still the best way to ensure that you can trust what you hear. Help WHYY remain your trusted source for news and information. Call 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online now at whyy.org.
The Oriental Rug Room at 10,000 Villages in Africa supports WHYY. Their annual rug event runs through February 27th with an Introduction to Oriental Rug seminar on February 12th. Info and registration at rugs.10,000villages.com.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about the psychological impact of natural disasters with Siddharth Shah, who's a physician, founded Greenleaf Integrated Strategies, who trains first responders to go into disaster areas, natural and less natural, all over the world. Joined here in the studio by Dr. Stephen Berkowitz, a child and adolescent psychiatrist at Penn, who specializes in trauma. And now we're joined on the phone by Gerda Nicholas. She's a psychology professor at the University of Miami. She specializes in trauma, was born in Haiti, and has family in Haiti. Gerda, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
So I don't know if you heard the question I posed almost to you before we went to our break about Haiti's history. It's, you know, it's already been devastated by conflict, poverty, floods, hunger. So, you know, I'm wondering, and now this, I'm wondering if this puts Haitians at more risk for PTSD. Does it beat them down more, or have they developed some coping strategies over the decades? Both.
Yeah, and I think it really is both, and I think it depends on the person also. You know, I think as a Haitian, as a people, you know, I think for the most part, we have developed a sense of our abilities to overcome. I think our history speaks to that, and I think to some extent we tend to use that history as sort of like our own sense of a capability of overcoming lots of obstacles and challenges. And at the same time, I think it does pose some difficulties in terms of how Haitians present themselves in the face of natural disasters and other ways, because they just don't present themselves in the same way that other people may have had, or the ways that we think that people should present themselves in natural disaster.
How so?
Well, you know, there's a sense of, in terms of Haitians, of really presenting themselves and ability to do, you know, because we tend, for the most part, to think of ourselves wanting to sort of still go about our day. So you will not see a Haitian who's talking about their difficulties of functioning or their difficulties of not taking care of their families or not taking care of the everyday situations, which oftentimes we might see with somebody else who's expressing depression or some other mental health-related issues. But that doesn't mean the person is not hurting psychologically.
Will it show differently?
It would absolutely show differently. Haitians feel most of their pain in their bodies. And for example, you know, oftentimes, and we've seen that not only with Haitians in Haiti, but also here as well, where the person will talk about sort of like the pain in the, you know, what we call the douleur de la corps, like a pain of the body. And it's a pain that's just not going away, and they've gone to see, you know, their medical doctors, and they've had lots of tests, and it's still there. You can also hear them talk about what we refer to as gas, which for us is sort of like an emptiness in the body.
Mm.
But it's one that's not is not able to be eliminated by eating better, right? So it's a way, it's sort of almost like a psychological pain that is there that is not going away, but the person is going to talk about it as if that they have this empty stomach.
So let me turn to you, Siddharth. You've talked a great deal about what happens when Western mental health professionals go into other cultures.
Well, right, and I'm really happy to be hearing about something like gas, which it means so much more than just that one word. It means how the body and the mind together are responding to distress.
Exactly.
And oftentimes, yes, and Western mental health workers oftentimes go to other nations and they do transnational work in a way that's problematic. They often go expecting to see the same signs and symptoms they've seen elsewhere. And I often liken that to playing tennis and there being nobody on the other side who's hitting back. It's like a mental health professional is looking for PTSD and they have their checklist, and they may or may not find so many things on the checklist, but in the meanwhile, the person on the other side of the net is saying, well, I also have this, I have gas, and I'm having difficulties with this, or I don't have enough food for my child to eat. And those are all issues of distress. They are very real, but they may not be on a PTSD checklist. So it's really important for mental health workers from other nations to really think through what is being said and have mechanisms to deeply listen to the local population.
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad you said that, Siddharth, because I think that's one of the issues that, in talking to my colleagues in Haiti, that we've noticed is that there is a sense of how do we transport westernized medicine to Haiti, and there will be a without an understanding of the cultural aspect of that, it will do more harm than good.
Well, speaking of the cultural aspect, let's listen to a clip, another clip of WHYY Susan Phillips, who was on earlier. This was recorded, of course, while she was in Haiti, but this is a nurse's description of how the people were coping.
Even though they've been through so much, I can get stories of what happened to them, but they pray a lot, and they sing spirituals, and that's what keeps them going. And so they're not questioning why God did this. They're just keeping their faith in God to bring them through it.
So what do Westerners need to know about Haitian culture before they go in and administer mental health services? Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
So what do Westerners need to know?
I think it's important that the clip did a really great job of sort of recognizing the importance of faith and the importance of spirituality in the Haitian people. So what they may be seeing, and oftentimes from a psychological perspective, we may see that as denial, as a coping mechanism. These individuals are not denying. So by singing and praising spiritual song and having faith is not a sense of denying the emotional experiences that they have. I think that's one. The other piece that really is important is the importance of family. and a recognition that by family, we're not just talking about nuclear family, that we are talking about a whole extended network of family. And I think oftentimes we lose sight of how important and how far-reaching the family is.
Well, this is similar to what you talked about earlier, Steve, about mm-hmm. about you know the extended network. But she was talking about faith, and faith is one of the protective factors in general with PTSD, isn't it, Steve?
Absolutely. People who have strong belief systems and also connected with that strong social supports typically are more resilient in general. I think one of the most beautiful things I ever saw was a film clip of a colleague and his wife in Indonesia who walked into a village and people were in shock. They were, for days, had not done anything. And they got them to start doing the ritual dancing. And you saw them come alive and rekindle their faith after the disaster. And I think you've seen some clips like that of Haitians doing the same thing. And that is something that brings people back and helps to heal. Is that support and that faith in the world?
And it's also something about in their body that moving the body in traditional ways.
Absolutely,
you know, it's body memory.
Exactly.
Absolutely
helps the mind.
And I think that was Siddhartha's point too about not simplifying the symptoms and the presentations.
So I want to talk to you, Steve, for a minute about symptoms, because we've learned a great deal about PTSD over the last 40 years and how to treat it. We've learned about what works and what doesn't work. And even a decade ago, we thought that talking about it over and over again was helpful. And now we're finding just the opposite.
Well, it's a little bit more complicated story than that, I think, which is that certainly early on, unless people are very symptomatic and impaired, we need to allow them to process and cope with support, not to force them to recount the story. If they are really symptomatic and they really do have PTSD, narrative exposures or even in vivo exposure where people actually do go over the event over and over and by mastering it, are the most effective modalities for PTSD, that particular diagnosis.
Not right away.
Not right away. Usually you're looking at 4-6 weeks later, unless earlier on they really are quite impaired and have what is now called acute stress disorder.
So, Siddhartha, I want to come back to you. You train first responders. First responders are going into these disaster areas having more or less knowledge of current research in their pockets.
Right, good point. For far too long, we've neglected the psychosocial care of relief workers themselves. So the staff of these relief agencies, they're the vehicles of our relief efforts. And then sometimes it's a surprise to us that they require psychosocial care themselves. But there are three obligations of any relief organization that get met by putting some psychosocial care attention on the relief workers themselves. The first one is that we put workers into harm's way. It's called vicarious trauma. And when people are conducting humanitarian missions, we owe those workers humane treatment themselves, and we owe them protection from the trauma that they could develop from working around trauma. The second thing is that psychosocial training given to workers translates into better and more sustainable care for the primary victims. If we don't teach workers techniques that can help them stay clear of trauma themselves, how do we expect them to assist others to do the same?
Well, it makes all the sense in the world. Let me turn to you, Steve. So what is it that first responders need to know to take care of themselves better?
I think there are a number of things, and I certainly refer to Siddhartha as an expert, but I think that certainly, again, the group cohesion and really supporting each other and being able to be available to each other is really quite protective. And I think one of the things that has shown up as being one of the most difficult things is the reintegration when they return. And sometimes they're not symptomatic. until they return and they attempt to reintegrate and find themselves not being able to enjoy the, you know, the day-to-day conversations because of what they've experienced. Everything seems so trivial. And we don't do a very good job in general in supporting that reintegration with their families and other loved ones.
Yeah, and we learned that after Vietnam.
The hard way.
And we haven't done a much better job. Gerda, in the last couple of minutes before that we have, tell me about you, about your family over there. I want to know how you're doing, how they're doing.
Well, you know, we are doing okay. I think it's been a really difficult time, and we've had a number of our family members lost in Haiti, and we continue to stay connected to a lot of our family members who have indeed survived. And I think one of the important part for this, for me, it's not just an issue about whether or not one has lost family members, but the opportunity to know that many people who is connected to you by culture, by language, by history, have perished, impacts you. And so it's one of the things I've been saying here in Florida when somebody says, well, how you doing? And if the person says, well, I didn't lose anyone, that does not mean they haven't been affected, you know, in a very, you know, similar way. But, I think it's been helpful for me to focus my energy on really addressing the needs of Haitians here in Florida. It's been great to work with colleagues around doing some work in Haiti, specifically in Cap Haitien. We'll be heading there in 2 weeks with a team of mental health providers to do exactly, I think, what Stephen and Zita are talking about,
well,
which is how do we provide the kind of training to medical personnel.
And we know, and you're a living example of this, that one of the best ways to cope with a traumatic event is to turn it into something meaningful, and you're certainly doing that. I want to thank all of you for joining us. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I think you've been so helpful. My guests today have been WHYY reporter Susan Phillips, who returned from Haiti recently, and check out our webpage to hear more about what the work she's done. Stephen Berkowitz, a child psychiatrist, specializes in trauma. He's here at Penn. Siddharth Shah is a preventative medicine specialist who trains relief workers. And we just heard from Gerda Nicholas. She's with the University of Miami, professor of psychology. Next week on Voices, we're going to be talking about compulsive shopping. Well, if you want to question or comment, we're at voices@whyy.org, and you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. The engineer for today's show has been John Knapp. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Gita Simons and Stephanie Maroudis produce the show. Me? I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends.
It's 12:50.